All right. Thank you. All right. So, of course, please don't hesitate to interrupt me at any point. Ask questions, start discussion, what have you. So I'm going to talk very briefly about some of the things that I think are most important to understand and give you some intuition for what limits our ability to estimate parameters of compact binaries with LIGO detections. So I'm going to go through. I'll give you a little bit about how parameters are measured, go into how well we measure them, and then go through some of the results that you've already heard briefly from Duncan and others throughout this workshop already, and just give you some of the kind of finer grained details behind them. So this is the layout of our compact binary pipeline. This is going all the way from raw data coming in the instrument to the final numbers that end up going into our publications. Online detection and low latency sky localization happen very short time scales. That happens as the data is coming out of the detectors. And this is what gives us our triggers and sky maps that go off to electromagnetic counterpart, look for electromagnetic counterparts to our EM observing partners. And then on longer time scales, days to weeks, we do this full parameter estimation. This is where we go back to the data and do a full forward model using the best models that we have at our disposal to try to characterize the binaries in detail. And also the significance estimates that eventually go into the paper that show our confidence in the full detection. So I'm going to focus on parameter estimation today. Yes? Yes. Yes, yeah, so there's already been a paper put out on that by Kip Cannon, Leo Singer, and a few others that look at doing these kind of alerts, real-time alerts before merger using GST-LAL, which is one of our online pipelines. And the punchline of that work is that it's very hard to get good sky localization well enough in advance. And so for now, that the signals spend so little time in band that it's not even something we've really worried about. But if it turns out that eventually once we lower our low frequency sensitivity and we can get binary neutron star signals in band for 30 or 40 minutes, then we'll probably reevaluate that and see if there's a...
So at the moment, there's no plan.
At the moment, as far as I know, there's no plan. I should also say that I am a member of the LIGO collaboration, but I am not speaking on behalf of the LIGO collaboration. Anything I say is not representative of the feelings of the LIGO collaboration. If I say we, I don't mean the LIGO collaboration. So yeah, I don't know. I don't think there are any clear plans right now. If we get down to 10 hertz, it can be 20, 30 minutes in band. Yeah, so it's going to be hard to get down to 10 hertz, but I think...
But it's also pushing the limits, right? Because that's a 1-1 at 10 hertz, which is very extreme. If you do 1.4, 1.4 at 20 hertz, which is more reasonable... Than
yeah.
It's 30 minutes.
It's not 30 minutes.
Yeah,
it's
30 minutes.
It's a few minutes.
A few minutes, yeah. He's saying 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could.
So there's both stuff that happened before the merger, and also just because of the telescope, so at merger, that's a good point. So a few seconds after is very different than a few seconds before.
Yeah, I mean, but this has been extensively discussed.
Yeah.
Right now, the low latency pipelines basically accumulate the SNR for the catalog to produce a trigger. In principle, the low latency pipelines could be reconfigured, although it's not been done yet, to say when the match filter for a given temple crosses an SNR threshold, generate a trigger rather than waiting until the end of the waveform. So it is something that has been discussed.
The sky localization is poor. Yeah. Plus the localization is going to be poor because basically at early times you have a sine wave, right? And trying to get time of arrival of a sine wave is really difficult, and that's what's kind of driving sky maps in a kind of character cartoon way. But yeah, I think that's definitely something we should talk about more if I don't think doing the full forward modeling has really been looked at with that kind of a scenario. It's been looked at in the detection regime a little bit, but.
But you also need to have a map SNR and a map detector.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to focus on just the parameter estimation, the detailed characterization of these compact binaries without speed really in mind. And so the way we do this, we don't take much information from those online detection algorithms that give us the triggers. We just take the fact that there was something interesting in the data at this time that passed through, we think, GeoCenter around this window. We analyze that data, and we use our approximate models, post-Newtonian-based ones, effective one-body-based ones, and we construct a full forward model of the entire network's data and use that to put estimates of the compact binaries parameters. And we do that through Bayesian inference. The one slide Bayes' theorem is we have our prior information on theta. These are the parameters that go into our model, things like masses, spins, orientation. The priors we use, we try to keep uninformative, so there's not much information there. And then this is our likelihood. This is where we update our priors with the data that we've measured, and we multiply those two to get our posterior function, and that's the probability density function that we publish and give as the uncertainties in our estimates of the parameters that go into the model. So the priors we use, we call uninformative. They are not all well-motivated. Some of them are very easy to define, so things like uniform in the local volume of the universe and isotropic in orientation. Some of the things that are more controversial are things like the mass prior we use. For now, what we've always used for the currently published results are flats in component mass space. And so that is a decision that could be argued over ad nauseum. We could use population synthesis inputs. Then we have to pick favorites. We don't get into that, so we just use uniform mass distributions. And this does affect our estimates of masses to some level. Things that we estimate very well, like chirp mass, that is a very peaked likelihood function. The likelihood function is very peaked as a function of chirp mass. And so you have very little change in that uniform component mass prior over the width of that peak in the likelihood. So the chirp mass is not very affected by choices in prior, but things like the mass ratio that we get much less certain are affected by priors. Our likelihood function, we actually use several different likelihood functions within the different analyses, but the main point is that we expect our noise to be Gaussian. So there's been a lot of detector characterization that's gone on. There's been a lot of vetting of the data before it's gotten to the point of going through this full parameter estimation algorithm. And so we can rest assured that the data is fairly Gaussian at the time of the signal we're analyzing. And so this likelihood function here is basically you just take your data, you subtract your model given some set of parameters theta, and you ask how Gaussian the residuals are. And that's just our likelihood function. We have some more sophisticated ones that try to model non-Gaussianities in the data. But all of that work is still very preliminary, and we don't use that for any publication information yet. But we can use that in the future if there's going to be questionable signals that are around times where the data may not be necessarily as Gaussian as we'd like. So the parameters that go into our models, I've kind of separated them here into well-constrained and not so well-constrained. This is just giving you a very, very broad view of what these parameter estimates look like. Chirp mass is something that we measure very, very well. It's this combination of a combination of component masses that goes into the post-Newtonian equations at a very high order. And it very strongly affects the phase evolution of the waveform. That we constrain very well. Total mass is something that we can also constrain very well. GW15 or 914 is an example of that. If it's a high enough mass signal that the merger is in the sensitive part of our frequency band, then the total mass is really affecting the merger and ring down. And so total mass we can constrain if we're sensitive to the merge and ring down like we were for GW15 or 914. The lower mass signals like GW15, 12, 26, merger is at higher frequencies where we're less sensitive, and the in spiral is really dominating the SNR that we get out of the data. And for that, really the chirp mass is the main mass measurement that we make. It's important to be able to measure both of these. That's what really gives us our certainty on individual masses, which is why GW150914 has better constrained masses than GW151226. And coalescence time is pretty well measured too. The things that we don't measure so well, mass ratio. So that is very degenerate with spin, and I'm going to go into that in some more detail. So these two are degenerate with one another when spins are aligned, but also when spins are a little bit misaligned, and I'll get into that. Distance and inclination also are very correlated. So especially with only the two LIGO instruments online right now, the two instruments are basically on purpose aligned with one another. The antenna patterns, those peanut shapes that Duncan had mentioned, are basically aligned. And that gives us sensitivity to only one polarization of the gravitational waves. And to be able to break the degeneracy between distance and inclination, if you put the binary further away, the amplitude goes down. If you take a face-on binary and you incline it, the signal to noise, the amplitude goes down. But where they differ is in the polarization content. As you incline the binary, you're changing the relative contributions of H plus and H cross, the two polarizations of gravitational waves. And so if we can measure two separate polarizations with our detectors, then we can start to break that degeneracy. And that is another reason, beyond just sky localization, why it would be great to have Virgo online. It's a different detector, different orientation, and we can start to measure both polarizations of gravitational waves fairly well and break that degeneracy. And then sky position and orientation. All right. Any questions so far? Yes? So first order, I mean, the most interesting factor of orientation is definitely inclination, but then also the rotation of the binary on the sky is degenerate with spin parameters when we start having precession and everything is flying around. So orientation is a little bit more information than just inclination, but that's really the most interesting probably. All right, so the mass spin degeneracy is something we've talked a lot about. It's something that's been known for quite a long time. And it's basically the fact that if you turn the knob on spin magnitude, so assume your components in your binary are aligned, they have spins that are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. If you turn the knob on the spin magnitude, it looks a lot like turning the knob on the mass ratio of the binary. The phase evolution, the effects on the phase evolution are very degenerate. This is a more recent study by Hanema et al. That are looking at what the effect is of that degeneracy. And so they put some constraints on here. They put various upper limits on spin for a binary neutron star system. And they show how the component mass estimates vary. So this is the secondary object, the less massive one on the x-axis, and the primary. They actually defined it in the other direction. Anyway, so primary, secondary. This is equal mass up here. And then how far down we go in component mass, how extreme the mass ratio can get, is affected by our assumptions for the upper limit on spin of the neutron stars. And this is something we looked at even more detail later on. And this is kind of evaluating how our priors really affect the mass estimates for binary neutron stars. The very vanilla analysis that we do, we use uniform priors in spin magnitude between 0 and 1, regardless of the masses of these objects. So it's a little bit different than that template bank construction that Duncan was talking about earlier. The choice on the maximum spin, we know a neutron star shouldn't spin at 1. So we can have a smarter prior implemented than that. But then the question is, what is the right upper bound on spin magnitude for neutron stars? 0.7 or so, depending on your choice of equation of state, is around breakup. If you go down further, you can get to 0.4. There's some good reasons to choose spins like 0.4. And then this is assuming no spin. So this is assuming the neutron star spin is negligible. And so this is showing you the same kind of picture, secondary mass on the x-axis, primary on the y-axis, how those choices in prior can affect the mass estimates that we get for binary neutron stars. This is a fair draw of the. So we simulated a local population of binary neutron star systems at random orientations, distances, uniform in volume. We simulated all of the data. We ran the full detection algorithms that would be running in a real scenario. We then have a down select, like a detected population, and then this is a fair draw from that detected population. So it's varying SNR. This is simulating the 2015 sensitivity, so it's basically 01 sensitivity.
So then each dot with a circle is the actual detected signal, and then the line is the degeneracy?
The dot with the circle is the simulated masses. So this is over, we simulated the masses between 1.2 and 1.6.
The detected signal, I mean the thing you ejected,
The thing we simulated, exactly, the injected signal there. And so these big bands, what this is doing is the width of the band, like Duncan mentioned earlier, is just the certainty that we can measure the chirp mass. These are following lines of constant chirp mass, basically. And then how far they go out in component mass space is just purely driven by our ability to constrain mass ratio. And so even though we simulated all of the sources down in this 1.2 to 1.6 solar mass range, our posterior estimates, if we don't impose that a priori, can go off to very extreme mass ratios. And so this is very indicative of the mass estimates that we are going to be able to make for the foreseeable future.
This also applies to the binary black hole if it doesn't merge within the band?
This does apply, exactly. So if it's a low mass binary black hole merger, where the merger and ring down are not very well measured, this is the same exact picture. The only thing that can differ is if we have strong spin. So this is also, this population was simulated with a maximum spin of 0.05. If we have black holes in there that can spin up to 1, and we allow for misalignments of those spins, we can start to break this degeneracy, and that's where it gets really interesting. But when we can't see precession and we can't break that degeneracy, this is the picture we have. And the same goes for spin magnitudes. So this is showing you the distribution of distributions that we can constrain for the spins of these individual components. And yellow is the spin of the primary. So remember, all of the simulated signals have spin below 0.05. And we can't tell that definitively with our normal priors, at least. So this is showing you the distribution of the primary spin estimates on these bands that are hard to see, kind of give you the width of that band. And so basically, for very, very few systems, we could ever rule out with 100% certainty that it wasn't maximally spinning, given the details of this simulation. Yeah, so when our priors are uniform in spin magnitude between 0 and 1 and isotropic in orientation. Yeah, so we allow for all orientations. And this is just another picture of the same thing, now moving to higher mass. So this is moving out of just the binary neutron star range and looking at a population of low mass compact binaries. And one question that we're going after with this is, if there is truly a mass gap between neutron stars and black holes, how sensitive would we be? Would we be able to tell if something is or is not in the mass gap with LIGO detections? And so this is showing, the circles again are the simulations. This box right here is showing where the mass gap would be. And it's not hard to see that all of these mass constraints go well through the box where the mass gap is. And so it's going to be a very difficult problem to try to find narrow gaps in mass space with LIGO detections.
Even for individual,
yes. So this is like 1,000. And this on the x-axis here is the simulated secondary mass. And on the y-axis is the recovered mass, the 90% bound in the mass. And so as the injected signals go through the mass gap, basically all of the uncertainties span well outside of in either direction of the mass gap. And so the ability to constrain something to being within the mass gap, if it's truly there, is really going to it's going to depend on us being lucky with a few different factors related to precession. That's right. So for this plot here, we're not including merger and ring down. So as you go to more and more extreme mass ratios, you're going up in total mass. And eventually, if merger and ring down were in the model, that would start coming into view, and we'd be able to start separating out. The model would not look like the data anymore. So maybe the extent of some of these uncertainties would be bounded a little bit tighter in if we had used in-spiral merger and ring down waveforms, which we didn't. But the basic picture is still the same. It's not going to do so well as to keep things down in the mass gap if that's where the uncertainties actually are.
This is an
advanced configuration. Okay. So this is 2 A LIGOs at design sensitivity and A Virgo.
Right. But looking, judging by the bands you've got there, the signals, the delta signals that you picked there are
Well, so we simulated a uniform population, and we imposed a Malmquist prior, so basically an SNR cut on the signals. Exactly. So this is kind of characteristic of the population we'll actually detect, sadly. Well, so the point is that if the signal is truly down here, merger and ring down, we're not sensitive to it. And when we run if we were to analyze the data with an in-spiral merger and ring down signal, as you start turning the knob on mass ratio and going out to these very high total masses, eventually the merger and ring down of your model starts to become in band. And so then we can start to separate that because it's not consistent with the data. But for this study, we just used in-spiral only waveforms because that's what we had at the time. Yes. Not unless we're very, very lucky. And I'll show you why in a second. So this is just showing you now the effects that we keep talking about, this precession that can break this degeneracy between mass ratio and spin. And this plot over here is just going to show you what the binary is doing. Over here is showing you the angular momenta in the problem. So black is the orbital angular momentum, red is the primary spin, and blue is the secondary spin. So you'll notice they're very misaligned in the very beginning, and we get the trading of angular momenta around these components, and that causes the whole orbital plane to precess. And when it precesses, because the inclination of the binary affects the amplitude of the gravitational wave, we get this modulation, this overall envelope imposed on top of the gravitational wave that's usually monotonically increasing in amplitude. And that effect is what we're looking for. That's what breaks that degeneracy between mass ratio and spin. The problem is that the amount of this modulation depends on the overall inclination of the binary. If we're looking at it face on, it doesn't have as big of an impact. And so to give you a little bit of an intuition for what I'm talking about, there we go. So here I'm showing the binary that I'm simulating. This is our view here on Earth. I have a black hole, so this is an asymmetric system to begin with. This is the spin of the primary component, so it's got a 30-degree tilt, a misalignment with the orbital angular momentum, and this is the gravitational wave that would be detected at Earth. So notice there's no very, very little precession effects here, even though this spin is at extreme, it's at 1. And so this, even though there is precession going on in the system, it's not very obvious in the data that we actually measure. Now, as we turn the knob on inclination and we start looking at this thing edge on, then we start to see those precession effects get very, very strong. The problem is that we are sensitive to gravitational waves everywhere. If we look at our prior shape, that is basically saying how likely we are to detect a given signal, it goes like d squared. It goes like distance squared. So we're more likely to detect things that are far away and face on than close by and edge on. So that's what I mean by we have to get lucky to detect these kinds of systems. We need to, every so often, we will detect something that's very nearby and edge on, but it's definitely not going to be the majority of the signals that we detect. Yeah.
when the endpoint is in, right, the observed signals, it was distinct. The answer was we can't tell the difference. Yeah,
sure. Between 0.5 and 0.01. Not very strong certainty. But so we're starting. Yeah. So there's. I'll get into the details of the measurements we've made so far. So it's true that we are finding it's more likely that spins are small than large. So we can tell for sure that it looks like not all black holes are spinning at 1 already. 0.5 is harder to rule out. Yeah. You're talking about the. Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's, but we can't rule out 0.5.
I think there's a distinction here as to what Searle is saying and what I was saying is just the in plane. If there were limits on the in plane, it would be 1.4.
Yes, yes.
The total.
Yes. And go ahead. Yes. Okay, so now to just give you a little intuition on how this precession can help us break this degeneracy, where the information is coming from, when we can start measuring properties of the primary black hole, when we can start measuring properties of the secondary. So now we're looking at this binary edge on, we get a nice view of the precession that's going on, and then we can start to turn the knob on tilt. So we can go from having that 30-degree tilt in the plane to aligned with the orbital angular momentum, and that turns that knob on all that modulation that's happening. And so this is where we start getting nice, rich information from the compact binaries. But if we give the secondary spin, in this case, we have an asymmetric system, the spin of that secondary, because it has less actual angular momentum, has less of an impact on the gravitational wave. So we've given it some spin. It's also extremal. Now we turn the knob on the tilt of that secondary, And it's having very little impact on the overall modulation that's happening, just because it has less angular momentum than the primary, and it's hard for it to throw around the orbital angular momentum. So when we move now from having that extreme mass ratio kind of set up to having an equal mass binary, now the secondary does imprint information on. And when we turn the knob on its tilt, it has very obvious effects on the precession. And so equal mass binaries that have very large spins give us lots and lots of information. And so if we're lucky enough to detect such a system edge on and there's misaligned spins, then it's a slam dunk. We can measure spins, we can measure masses, we can do tons of interesting measurements with that kind of data.
Just one comment on when they get to see that, what you talked about, then it's going to be matching the disruption strongly depends on the characteristics for the waveforms.
The disruption.
Yes.
So the So that's going to happen at high frequencies, though, and it's going to depend on the mass ratio exactly, and if we're actually sensitive to when this thing disrupts or not. And so, yeah, that's something that could potentially be very interesting, but it's really going to depend on the details.
Well, the black hole neutron star, you get the extreme mass ratio. The mass ratio is more extreme, it's more extreme.
Yeah.
Could you repeat that?
I said for neutron star black hole, the spin is dominated by the black hole spin, so it becomes easy to know you spin the black hole is dominated by the star black hole.
And because if you have higher mass, if the observations that we know are telling us something, it's already pushing the frequency. In a regime where you actually have LIGO sensitivities.
That's right.
So you don't have to get as LIGO.
That's right.
I'm really confused about this conclusion that, if the Hula course at comparable mass, then the precession is stronger, because this is not what generally we see. I mean, we generally see that for equal mass, for spinning, we can actually recover the signal very well with a higher spin. It's more in the large mass ratio.
So I mean, the fact is that both of, when it's equal mass and both black holes are extremal, they can both have a strong imprint on precession effects. And so,
you're thinking of search templates for which are preferentially detecting face-on things.
This is edge-on.
Are you for parameter estimation?
The two problems are coupled, right? If the search problem is easy, then parameter estimation is difficult by definition. It's the same one.
Okay. All right. So this is just to try to give you some intuition for how precession can break degeneracies, where information is coming from, and when we get lucky with these kinds of measurements, how lucky we need to get to be able to start estimating things very precisely. All right. So I'm running low on time. I'm going to speed ahead. So this is going back. If we look at this, this is the overall population. And now this is taking that same simulation that we had before, where we were evaluating our probability of measuring things in the mass gap, and just looking at what's really defining our ability to constrain the secondary mass accurately. And this is showing you the opening angle of the precession cone of the simulation. And on the y-axis here is the uncertainty in our mass ratio estimate. And it gets tiny when we have a nice large opening angle of that precession cone. And so it's that precession that's really giving us our ability to put constraints on mass ratio. All right, so the models that we have used so far within LIGO for the publications that we have, they're all in-spiral merger ring-down waveforms. They have the complete waveform because we need it to go to high frequencies, to these high masses that we've been detecting. SEOBNRV2 is an aligned spin waveform that models the full in-spiral merger and ring-down, but assuming that the components have spins that are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. IMR Phenom PV2 is the name for this frequency domain waveform that is in-spiral merger and ring-down and starts to model the effects of precession. So it doesn't have information on each individual spin, each individual component spin. It has this effective spin treatment where it has the what we call chi-effective, which is that aligned mass-weighted combined components of the spin aligned with the orbital angular momentum, and chi-p, which is basically a measurement of the in-plane analog. And then finally, SEOBNRV3, this is the kind of kitchen sink model. This is where we start having information on each individual component spin go into it. And it's, again, a full in-spiral merger ring-down waveform. But the problem is it's very computationally expensive, too much so for us to do low-mass binary parameter estimation. We need to generate millions of waveforms in serial to estimate the parameters of one individual source. So it's very hard to use expensive waveforms. This was used to analyze GW150914, and there's a paper that goes through and gives you the updated parameter estimates using that complete model. but it's too expensive to use right now on GW 15, 12, 26, and LVT 15, 10, 12.
So these are still just analytical sort of questions calibrated against numerical relativity. It's not actually iterating calculation numerical relativity.
That's right. So it's not actively using numerical relativity. It's tuned to numerical relativity simulations offline. Right. And we have then we have the model.
Do better by iteratively.
Yes. That's right. It doesn't matter. In principle.
And also, assuming you have as many templates as you want, do you go in sequence to all of them, or is there a strategy where you just try to get some first, get some bulk, and then you go deeper and add even further physics?
You mean the methods behind the parameter estimation? Or?
Well, I mean, if I imagine you take every member of the template democratically, and you try to get a first course pass.
So for parameter estimation, we do a completely stochastic Markov chain Monte Carlo approach. So we generate points at random in parameter space and then jump at random around parameter space sampling from the posterior. So there's no fair.
I think he's talking about approximate rather than template, right? And in that case, what we do is we do a parameter estimation using SUVNR, we do a parameter estimation arm up and on P, and we treat those as error in the waveform understanding, right? So the limits we quote include the statistical errors which come from the MCMC, which you get each waveform family, and then the systematic that you get is you get the parameter estimation with SUV and RV0.
Yeah, so we use the differences between these two waveforms as an estimate of systematic uncertainty, and it's not really the right thing to do, but the posteriors for these are close enough in the parameters that they share that it's okay for what we've done,
for what we've
seen so far.
Yeah,
but that's only assuming. But that's true when you assume that the systematic's under control.
Yeah.
That this is a good. That's what I'm saying. It's a circular argument. It's a circular argument.
We compare also with
NR. Yes. For ones we've seen so far, it's true. Statistical dominates systematic so far. Yes.
But my question was going on to somewhere else. You mentioned that this is very competition encoded.
Yes. As long as that is a conservative estimate of uncertainties, as long as there's not an overall bias that kind of treatment would apply to our, so you could imagine doing a crude analysis, getting broad posterior estimates, and then using a more expensive one with those as a prior to try to keep you in the right part of parameter space. And so it's hard to imagine that doing, it wouldn't really save us that much time because we'd still have to evaluate millions of waveforms.
I'm thinking of something else. I'm thinking of you give me templates, and how do you face that problem? If you try to go, so suppose you have durability templates and some alternative theory for gravity. How would you go? Well, I would imagine you go first with your workhorse, then get some parameters, and then try to see in the other one, or you can just restrict the parameter space that you would be looking for.
Versus
yeah, I mean, so Richard's talking about burn-in versus sampling, and so the one thing that we could save on by knowing roughly the right part of parameter space to go into is burn-in. So when we start off our MCMCs, we just pick some random spot in parameter space, and then they wander uphill until they get to the posterior, and then they sample it. Okay. So we could save in that cost. That step is basically where we could save some cost, but that's a pretty minimal effect on top of the millions and millions of waveforms that we generate to actually sample the posterior. But
so we have now in discussion.
Okay. So I can get into the results. Yes. All right, so this is where you're going to see lots of preliminaries. Please ignore them. This is the O1 BBH result. So this is the kind of figure in the paper that compares all the signals we've detected so far. Duncan already showed it. This is showing the results from the SUV and RV2 waveforms, the spin-aligned waveforms. If we show the results for the processing waveforms, then we start to see a little bit of modulation pop up here. And these guys are basically monotonically increasing in amplitude. So this is GW 15, 12, 26 is where we start to get the most flexibility for precession being there. No. And so that's a tricky thing. And so the evidence for precession, so basically the model, when we give it the flexibility of precession, doesn't seem to fit the data any better. But the modulation that it allows is totally allowed within the noise model. So we can have some appreciable modulation in the amplitude. It's allowed by the data, but it's not demanded by the data. So it's basically a toss-up right now. We don't really know for sure if it was precessing or not. It's a little bit of both. I mean, there's some, the modulation, the amount of modulation that's allowed is basically constraining how far the tilt can go crazy of the secondary. So let me just skip ahead. So this punchline is that our mass estimates, these look nice and precise, they're muddied up by our inability to measure distance. So once we start getting to high mass systems that we detect far away, redshifting occurs, and the effects of redshift on gravitational wave measurements is to redshift the mass estimates that we make. So this is the constraints we put on detected masses. So this is in the detector frame, but when we account for the redshifting that happens to the gravitational wave on the way to us, that's where we get these broader uncertainties that kind of fatten up this, especially GW151226, but also GW150914 and LVT151012. So distance uncertainty affects our ability to actually constrain source masses. All right, so this is showing you the kind of constraints that we can put on spin right now. So in terms of precession. So these are the two parameters that go into our precessing IMR phenom P waveform. The x-axis here is the in-plane component of the spin, and the y-axis is the aligned component of the spin. So this is for GW150914. We constrain the effective spin to not be huge in either direction. And the in-plane component of the spin, we basically recover our prior. So we get very little information on the in-plane component. LVT151012 is basically the same picture. We can put constraints on the aligned component of the spin, that it's close to zero, no constraints, very little constraints on the in-plane component. And then where it gets interesting is GW151226. Here, we constrain the effective spin to be above zero. So we are 99% certain that chi effective is above zero, meaning that at least one black hole has to have spin. We don't know necessarily which one for sure, but we show that at least one component of that binary has non-zero spin. And then the in-plane component, we start to put a little bit of constraint on, but it's a little dicey. So this is showing you now the three-dimensional constraints on spin of the primary objects and the secondary objects. And each of these is going to be a three-dimensional cloud that's basically the probability density of the tip of the spin of each of those components. And so right here is where the most constraint has happened so far. This is for the primary component in GW151226. We constrain it to be above the plane of the orbit, so it's aligned with the orbital angular momentum to some degree, but there's a reasonable amount of flexibility for there being tilt there. And so the way that we show this in our publications is that these are these spin disk plots, and this is marginalizing over the azimuthal angle, the azimuthal orientation of the spins, and just showing you in the radial direction, the spin magnitude, and along the arc is the misalignment from the orbital angular momentum. And these are binned histograms, and the bins were constructed to have equal prior weight to each bin. So anything that, this is a representation of our prior in the spin disk plot way of showing this information. And so then anything that deviates from this nice uniform disk is the data actually informing our measurements. So this is for GW150914. We constrain the spins away from high and aligned and high and anti-aligned. But if they're in the plane of the orbit, we put very little constraint on the spin magnitude. So there's a lot of flexibility for the in-plane component of the spin, basically. So from this, we know that black hole spins, not all black hole spins are extremal and aligned. For LVT151012, it's basically the same thing. Was there a question? Almost, exactly. So it's not extremal and aligned. We can say that already. And basically, it's the same kind of thing from LVT151012, assuming it's an astrophysical source. Because there's more flexibility for going to unequal mass ratios, we put less constraint on the secondary. It has less of an impact on the gravitational wave. But the primary spin, again, we can rule out this high and aligned and high and anti-aligned spins. And then GW151226, this is where it gets interesting. These are the constraints on the primary spin of that object. And here we basically are constraining it to, so notice first there's a significant probability at aligned. So we can't say that there's definitely precession happening here. We can't say that the spin is definitely misaligned with the orbit, with the orbital angular momentum, but we get this nice constraint on basically where that spin can be, and this is where the information is basically.
Mass of that compound, approximately?
15, for the primary? It really, so it could be anywhere from equal mass to unequal mass. We really don't know. When we quote those unequal numbers as just single point estimates, it's not a good representation of that banana shape that we actually measure. All right, so that is basically all I wanted to say. I'll just throw my summary up here and take any more questions you may have. Thank you. Yes? Yeah, so the what we're talking, when we say systematic error, what we usually mean is error that's introduced in our analysis because the approximate waveform models we're using aren't truly representing nature. And so for the events we've detected so far, the way that we've estimated systematic uncertainties is twofold. One is to use two different models that we think are equally well motivated. One puts more emphasis on precession effects, and the other puts more emphasis on individual spin information from the two components, but aligned. And both of those, for the parameters that they share, the posterior estimates are very similar. So if that is that's one way that we look at systematics. The other is to use the numerical waveforms that we have at our disposal and to look at, do a detailed analysis of the data, trying to use all those numerical relativity waveforms as a separate way to evaluate systematic uncertainties. And basically, everything looks very consistent so far. So those are the two approaches that we're using to see if our systematics are under control for the sources we have so far. It depends on the spins that they have. So it's exactly the same physics that's been defining the black hole stuff that I've really focused on. The problem is that if spins, so all the neutron stars we see so far, millisecond pulsars are the fastest spinning ones, their spin is still very tiny. It's below 0.1. And so that effect on the waveform is very minimal. And so if we're trying to distinguish between 0.05 and 0.1 spin, it's very difficult. Yes?
You listed distance as one of the things that's hard to get.
Yes. So for GW150914, we measured the distance to be about 400 megaparsecs, give or take 150 megaparsecs.
That's pretty
it's pretty good. For LVT151012, that was about a gigaparsec away, plus or minus like 500 megaparsecs. And so that is really driven by our inability to break this distance inclination degeneracy. When Virgo comes online and we start to measure two different polarizations potentially, we can break that degeneracy and put tighter constraints on distances, especially for far away ones. Hope so.
Is it going to be a problem finding counterparts for the black hole systems? Neutron stars are more promising.
So, there's a question of how much you can really leverage distance information. So instead of just giving two-dimensional sky maps, we can give three-dimensional volumes. And that's something we're going to be doing in O2. And as far as our actual ability to constrain, to tighten up the volume of those 3D volumes, that's going to be dependent on sensitivity increases in LIGO. It's going to be sensitive to Virgo's, whatever sensitivity Virgo comes online with.
It's hard because the reason I said LIGO is built as a detection network, and the detectors are as aligned as possible given the curvature of the Earth. And so you don't get that polarization. So you really need Virgo to break the degeneracy, get the polarization, and then you can start to get information.
But you can tell the difference between 100 megaparsecs and gigaparsecs.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And just to emphasize, this is a direct measurement of this gas. This is unlike any of the other measurements in this thing. This is, we run a tape measure out of 400 megaparsecs and that's what
Yes. Yeah.
And I realize that now when you look at this applying like correlated GRPs with trying to search for sources. But is there any effort to do that quasi real time for the GRPs or other sources to try to immediately after GRP happens?
So we do externally triggered searches, but I don't think they're done with much speed in mind.
They're
done quickly now? Okay. Is it fully automated, though? It's still done by hand, right?
Here, I think, is not GRB.
No, it's not GRB timescales. That's the, it's It's not months, but it's not hours either, right?
But in one of the things that is working on this is when you get a GCN to say, we run the low latency analysis anyway, right? So you're looking for neutron star black hole, neutron star light, neutron star black hole, neutron star low latency. So when we get a GCN, was there an associated trigger generated by the low latency alert? If there was, then something back out very quickly.
But that's not redoing the search with a stronger power constraint that it was based on.
But effectively, you're triggering and saying, what you would do is you would say, look for something with a, we know the effect is it's about a 10-20%